Anton Capella is a versatile guy. He has worked all over computer science, broadcasting, and the wireless industry. He's a seasoned technology executive, co-founder, inventor, and investor with a history in electrical engineering, a penchant for computer science, and a artistic flair. Capella has worked at Five Nines, Earthlink, Edge Micro, Windy Apple, Cloudflare, and at Clutch Sound Studio, which started out in the former Smart Studios. Anton owns the independent LPTV, local power TV channel, K03IMD, in Eugene, Oregon. Anton's interests include drums, bass guitar, art and hockey, electrical engineering, computer science, and business. And if his last name, Capella, sounds familiar, it's because Anton is the son of the beloved National Weather Service meteorologist, Rusty Capella, at NOAA Sullivan, who helped us with EAS. Welcome, Anton.
All right. Things first, sound check. We'll make it. All the gain, none of the feedback. How's that? Cool. Great. Not my vocal chain, not my laptop, so we're going to trust everything works great for the show ahead. All right, so what's this all about? Really, it's about doing things with technology that you didn't expect possible. This is actually, a low-power station. This is not a translator, despite the call sign. That's just an inherited affect of what was on the CP when I acquired it. And the point here is that we've taken a facility that can clearly, and I think we all know well, transport arbitrary datagrams in transport stream packets, and I thought about repurposing it for something more. And this is ultimately depends on implementing something meaningfully different or new in a compression decompression system. So this is the first jargon I'm going to throw at you, codec. There's a lot more jargon to come. So I'm going to pause here for a moment. I'd recommend taking your phone out, doing a zoom shot of some sort, just to keep this at the ready. I'm not going to stop much to expand a lot of acronyms or initialisms. I'm going to expect that we have that kind of on our minds or maybe archived from here. This presentation also, fair warning, is designed for a later distribution to the audience and attendees of the Broadcasters Clinic. I'm not going to speak or talk through most of the text. We're going to look at the pictures and enjoy some of the results. How's that? We're going to have a demo as well. So to really bring this thing into the topic area of the clinic, I want to cover a little bit of my past that we didn't hear from Vicky, but is, I think, somewhat relevant here. What's happening at the station today and what's going to happen, what I want to do in the near future. So this, for me, in wireless terms, is just a continuation of my interests in free space propagation phenomena. You know, take an E&M model of anything and run it forward from, you know, basic textbooks as a child through running a mesh network in Madison when Wi-Fi got to be cost-effective and interesting, up to the point of a wireless ISP through the data center company that I ran here for some time, and then accelerate into a various, sort of backgrounded area in global internet operations. I dabbled as a kind of a hacker playboy of a sort in network security. If you want to go on google.com, you can look up Capella and BGP, Bravo Golf Papa. That was a fun couple years looking at network routing protocol security. And then shortly after that, my friend Alex and I moved on to something back in the wireless space, which is all about super ultra low latency radio communication systems. Alex and I built the first high frequency trading microwave network between Chicago and New York, beginning at roughly millisecond round-trip times per modem pair, developing and perturbing that down to 10 microseconds round-trip per pair. SAF and others today totally jacked our designs and ran with it, and we're cool with that. That's fine. They gave us a nod and a couple dollars, so we'll take it. But this is where I'm coming from. This is my DNA. So making stuff do what it's not supposed to do and making it work the way I want it to work. And so, you know, really, my history ignored, unfortunately, and I have to admit, broadcast. I was coming up on the packet switch generation. I was really concerned with the internet and things that dealt with messages I could interact with on systems, wireless or otherwise. And broadcast was completely outside my world. I mean, I tacitly knew about FM, you know, AM stuff, the fundamentals of what is in the channel physics, of course, but not the applications and the economics and everything else for audio and video media at large. And then I find myself, fast forwarding several years, to sitting at home during COVID, and I get a new TV in 2020. Now we're not doing very much, right? We're kind of working remote if we are working. And all of a sudden I realize that my fancy LG OLED display of a big diameter, big width, and lots of pixel density, I'm still looking at MPEG-2 with the same resolutions that I was dealing with on IPTV systems in 2004. That seemed weird to me. Why don't I have something better and cooler and newer and interesting on the air yet? Well, we didn't have any ATSC 3.0 in Madison at that time. We still don't yet. So I thought, well, this is an interesting way to play with something over this long break, and here we are. So I thought, you know, okay, the payload is not much. It's 19 meg and change, and what can I do with that? You know, I realize, of course, the codec of choice for anything above 1080 is going to be high-efficiency video coding. So at that point, I'm thinking, what can we do, and how can I get this stuff to my TV? I'm not a broadcaster yet. I don't have a ClearQuam head end or anything like that. So I set out to go do it. Get some stuff from DeckTech, throw it on DVB-C, transmit across the room to the circled red antenna on the floor, and bada bing, bada boom, we're getting some streams through. Real basic stuff, MPEG-2, MPEG-4, advanced video codec kind of stuff. We're not touching HD or Ultra HD really yet. But it works, and I was encouraged by that. But then it doesn't work all of a sudden. Have you ever seen this kind of a thing before in your stations or your friends' video systems? Never. You'd never do that. How about like that, where you can't even start decoding like the second or third scan line, or rather a slice of the frame? So you learn quickly what does and doesn't work, and you learn quickly what can and cannot fit in the mirror 19.3 megabits, which is left of the red line. And if you look to the right of the red line, you realize, oh, wow, lots of the stuff coming off the world's encoders and production facilities is really targeting high bit rate delivery, 10, 20, 30 plus megabits per stream, especially at Ultra HD resolutions. And so I thought, well, what can I do to squeeze this more? I know how codecs work, right? I think I know how codecs work. Let's see how far I can take that down. Turns out, I had the facility still at Five Nines to use a personal rack of gear, and I could throw some hardware in there and amassed just under a terahertz of CPU capacity to work with this through a variety of different codec implementations. So I'm testing literally everything I can get my grubby little hands on, from main concept, Fraunhofer, FFmpeg, open source X265 projects, you name it, and figured out a couple things. One, the code looks pretty gnarly, and I don't want to do anything myself, so I have to write some software to manage the software to understand and can code and work with this sort of infrastructure. Having done that, I finally got the stuff working pretty well. I got visual results that I was happy with, and unfortunately, even with the best and latest, greatest CPUs I could afford at the time, the encoding throughput was not great. That's pretty slow, right? But heck, it looked good. And we're just going to do offline encoding anyway. We're going to throw things into a carousel, what I guess the industry calls playout. And we're going to just run files from disk to a stream to a nice transport layer over the air, right? So, but that doesn't help me for live. Having achieved this good-looking result, which we'll show and demonstrate later, I thought, well, this needs to get like 10 times faster, but I'm not going to throw several kilowatts and architect a parallel encoder facility to get from 3 frames a second to 30 or more. Turns out NVIDIA has GPUs that do this mostly for you, and if you perturb yet more gnarly looking code, you can get there pretty reliably and pretty visually appealingly. Is that a word? And we get done with that sort of thing, we figure out, you know, that this is all great, but what's the real, you know, underlying theme here? What are we doing with all this magic stuff? Well, so one of my favorite, you know, public intellectuals and scientists out there said something really simple and poignant, and that really points out to me that it's all about expressing the gestalt of what is in, you know, the meaningful information that we want to share, send something, share somewhere. And so if we were to consider all the things that were printed at the time that he said this in the 70s, it's pretty true that even with analog NTSC video, there is just a preponderance of redundancy. and everything else that followed from it wants to kind of squeeze this out further and further and further. So I took this a bit personal. You know, so the question for me was, what bits are the valuable ones to explore and to exploit? So looking more closely at codecs, we discover that there's a couple things you can discover and know about these constructs. And we know that the way that these systems work exploits things about our senses and our perception that are just baked into us. We can't see certain things. We can't hear certain things. There's things called masking coefficients, silencing potentials that are all pervasively present in the audio and video experience or the visual experience that we have in normal life. And so what we're doing with all of this stuff is exploiting in some way or borrowing. We're finding some efficiency to shortcut the totality of explaining, of course, to the display or to the listener and viewer what they're intended to see and hear. I love this little example here that really helps me share with an audience just how effective some of these masking and coloration challenges can be. If you were to look at this picture here, you'll note that the green, red, and blue lines are alternately masked, if you will, or present in front of the balls. And if you look at those balls, you see that they have some different tonality, right? What color are some of the balls? There's only three colors up there. What do you guys see? Someone say it loud. Right. Well, wrong. Just by basically alternately masking and unmasking those lines, we can see they're all the same tone. This is hard to do at a distance, so forgive me for the lack of impact here. When you guys get a slide deck copy or a PDF, you'll really appreciate this when it's much more closely spaced to you. But we find that people's eyes and perception of these tonalities depends on which foreground line is crossing the ball. So the balls with red lines and green lines and blue lines will generally look more of that tone, despite them all being the same actual color. Another great example of this fun codec exploit is that with just alternately masking green and blue lines, we can create the perception of completely different colorations of the shape of the heart here. What color is the heart? What do you think? It's red. Sorry, Matt. And so this is a really awesome one to conclude with. When we look at the sort of work in video codecs today, a lot of it's on squeezing and encoding visual information in a static, kind of frame-by-frame sort of sense. But what we know and what we realize in motion video is that what's important to also squeeze out is the difference between frames and things over time. And so as of a pretty recent year, 2010, lots of cognitive psychologists were looking at what's the thing we don't know about yet that we haven't seen or discovered in terms of visual anomalies, or call it optical illusions. And it turns out the entire class of, call it lack of sensitivity or under-sensitivities, exists around this example here. It's going to be difficult where you all sit to appreciate this as well, but if you stare at the green dot, you'll generally notice that as the circular dots move and rotate left-right, your a sense of their color changing will tend to reduce or stop or completely halt. This is much more impressive if you're 3 inches from your screen or so. But trust me when I say that this is the underlying theme for what we'll introduce next, which is how to use this sort of stuff in a real environment and how we can squeeze these big frames and at reasonable frame rates down into almost no real data. So I wanted to show and highlight 2 frames from a movie, Blade Runner 2049. So obviously, I don't hold copyright, can't claim anything on these images. So please don't reproduce them beyond the conference here. And so these 2 frames will show us just a couple of examples of coding challenges. What I want to highlight here in the left third of the frame is that there's a lot of scene lighting changes. You see it gets brighter and darker. And it's also diffuse sort of light propagation through this entire scene. There's direct light behind haze and other sorts of some sort of speculation. And there's lights reflecting through it from the front side as well. When we want to encode this now, many encoders would typically see this as just a change in the frame and not a reference to another piece of data that we could borrow. But when we start to apply things like visual silencing, spatial silencing principles, we find that we can actually describe the majority of this frame with completely existing data from other frames ahead and behind those frames. So again, this is the same two frames. And what we're showing here is a visualization of these white and gray lines telling us which frame motion vector region is pointing to something else, meaning that this frame's constructed from pointers that are not in that frame. And I want to highlight the fact that from frame to frame, these are incredibly different. They're tremendously decorrelated is the technical term here. And if we search and find decorrelating motion vectors, we tend to exploit the principles we'd mentioned here in the silencing mechanisms. Altogether, this means we signal and send almost no original data. We have merely mentioned and referenced pointers to previously signaled image elements and data that we've already given the display and the decoder tens of or 20s or 30s of frames in the past. After we do all that magic cool encoding, what are we left with? And this is kind of the segue into the challenges that I'm getting back into the earlier work we mentioned here in terms of getting this on a real channel. Had to then overcome. So when we do all this stuff, we will end up with independent frames, so-called keyframes, the iframe, colored green here in the vertical bar, and predicted frames that are looking at past frames, the blue bars, and then bidirectional predicted frames that are looking at frames in the future and the past. So you'll note that progressively, on the average, we show just one example here, but those two green ones are several hundred kilobytes describing a 3840 by 2160 frame, independently encoded, meaning we're taking up to 8 megapixel Luma samples and 2 megapixels of Chroma samples, and smashing them all together and getting only a couple hundred kilobytes of result. Think of this like a super duper JPEG, without being JPEG XS or anything weird, okay? And then comparing that frame to frames after it in time, we find that there's relatively small deltas if we do all this exhaustive motion search. If we're not encoding new macro blocks and not wasting time, if you will, wasting space rather, signaling new information, we can just use pointers and borrow tremendous amounts of previously shared information. And that's what we see then coming out of our encoder. Here's where the challenges enter in and where it gets really fun. What we end up constructing is then these groups of pictures, which are now incredibly, call it tightly interrelated. I want to highlight or direct your attention to the vertical black line here. There's no laser pointer on this, is there? Oh, thank you. Jeez. So this black line here shows us the current selected frame in an analysis tool provided by Elecard StreamEye. Awesome tool, by the way. If you haven't worked with any MPEG stuff, this is a great way to understand stream and codec formats, because you can see everything. What I want to highlight here is the current frame, this black line on frame, is that display 286? 826, there we go. This frame, you'll see, points to 5 previous frames. Some of them are B frames, some of them are P frames, meaning that those frames themselves were pointing to 2 or more frames, and the P frames could point to multiple previous frames as well. Meaning that as we successively decode from this iframe forward, we are doing as little work as possible and sending as little additional information as we can to give the decoder some idea of what the next frame should look like. And we're borrowing as heavily as possible from all previously sent data. That's what we're saying here. I just want to highlight that because what we will not see on current ABC and HEVC broadcasts is typically more than 1 or 2 reference frames. The decoders out there that we discovered and tested from channel 3 in the Eugene market seem to support at least 5 reference frames. Why wouldn't anyone exploit that? Shrug. I am. This is what you can do as well with your hardware or NVIDIA or anything else you can choose. So after we get all that stuff encoded and compressed and squeezed really, really tightly, we end up with, again, this big, call it peak to average ratio problem. Look at the order of magnitude we're talking about here. A couple hundred kilobytes, single kilobytes, 1,000 to 1. That's a big difference. How do we paste that information then onto a stream that can sustain and work over the broadcast channel at a 19.3 megabit or less fixed rate? Good question. This is the job of now the multiplexer and various playout hardware. And this is where we hit some roadblocks and where Steve sitting in the audience there, I really, again, owe him a debt of gratitude to make this work in their hardware. Because when we do put this on the wire, we expect something like this to show up at the receiver. Just for a basic understanding of what you're seeing here, on the horizontal axis, we're counting from the first TS packet to the last TS packet, approximately 14,000 packets shown on the screen here. And the red icon indicates the playback clock, a program clock reference value. So that you'll notice again on the vertical axis, this is the absolute value of those timestamps for the PCR. The blue and overlaid green triangles and everything else give us a clue on the timestamps that represent an individual frame where it occurs in time. So if you were to imagine yourself being a receiver or a decoder for a moment, you'd be stepping, if you will, from bottom to top and playing the frames at the time they're supposed to get played, decoding them when they're supposed to get decoded. All the while, the clock is telling you what time it will be next, next, next. Meaning that there is always, and intentionally then, a gap between the program clock reference and the decode and presentation timestamps. And thou shalt not cross the two. That's the big rule. Hint at the problem that we face later on. So when we started working with this stuff, this is now a challenge for us to place these big bursty pictures on the wire and keep the timing system sensible around all of it, because again, we have to have a PCR that is coherent. It is properly formatted relative to the timestamps of the underlying audio and video programs. And so once we do all those things, we can make the stuff work. Quick takeaways, though. What makes everything work for Channel 3 and would work for any other station at 2160 resolutions or greater is essentially this list of inputs, if you will, call it ingredients, that the encoder needs to basically have. If we take any one or two of these things away, we don't get good results. That's the bottom line here. We don't want to go through this laboriously since we have some cool stuff ahead, so feel free to research and Google these terms and concepts after the talk here or see me in the hall. So the one important comparison here in terms of why is it worth expending all this effort and time on encoding things so aggressively, so complicatedly, is that we're not the internet over the top world. We're not doing things like YouTube scale, which is absolutely astoundingly silly. Over 30,000 hours of video uploaded every hour. And they want to encode and convert and reformat that for dozens or maybe hundreds of different screen geometries, resolutions, and bitrate ladders accordingly. In the case of broadcast, we have a radically simpler problem space. And this is what I want to really invite the crowd here in the room to consider. I have to only worry about one program stream to one display area. If you don't have a 4K TV, you aren't playing my program. I don't care then, right? I'm free to not worry about that. If I do a 1080 ABC or 1080 HEVC, and it's got high dynamic range, wide color gamut, magic, 60 frames a second, you can't play that unless your TV does that. That's radically different and a tremendous departure now from what we're familiar with and accustomed to in a mobile phone or a laptop or computing type environment. So I want to point that out and emphasize it just one more time, because this is the reason any of this is okay, in my opinion. And additionally, no one's comparing my over-the-air broadcasts real-time to AB or ABX sorts of scenarios, meaning we're not up against someone, you know, saying and playing alongside a Blu-ray or comparing my over-the-air feed to a national private encrypted satellite source, say a sports or other sort of content, meaning that as long as it doesn't look totally terrible, I think we have a chance in getting interest and gaining new audience around the enablers of specifically high frame rate and wide gamut sort of formats. Let's pick on some things though. This is a pair of frames from the movie Tenet. And I had to look through the entire thing and send this to some director editor buddies to really have them tell me what they thought looked the worst of it. And if we really strain our eyes and come up close to the screen and look really, really closely, we'll notice that around the hair, there is some usual, you know, DCT-isms, cosine transform-isms of weird frequency, low-passing effects given the motion. And if we compare two frames to each other, we'll notice that, yes, when they move among these frames, the predictions break down, we send new macro blocks, and the quantizers are way high, really, really high. We're throwing almost all the data away because we can't match a motion vector. We don't have film grain synthesis. We don't have geometry synthesis. We have none of the cool features we need to describe that with less than the whole macro block level of transform data. So sue me. But again, this frame lasted 20 you know, a brief period of time. This frame was on your screen for about 41 milliseconds at 24p. So would you have noticed that? Probably not. You're probably looking at where she's looking with her eyes. You're probably watching her expression, not her hair. My assumption. So another scene from Tenet, high action scene. This involves a camera pan and two people moving, and it's shallow depth of field, shot on, I think, actual 70 millimeter film, because Nolan's like that, and left the grain in, okay? And we can kind of see some of this coloration and deblocking kind of overlapping the shadow of the motion effects here of the scene. But this, again, is at an incredibly low rate. I didn't mention that yet. I don't want to spoil a surprise. We're going to see some live videos and hopefully really build an appreciation for how low this can go. Last example to nitpick is some stuff from original Blade Runner in the 82 release. This, to me, is the frontier right now, the challenging area of encoding. Again, moving, diffuse, smoky things with grain, with multiple compositing layers, and all kinds of complexities around that, which really reveal some of the shortcomings of current motion silencing and other encoding techniques today. And one of the maybe the most dramatic from that scene, just after Leon abruptly ends the Voight-Kampff test, is a bullet through this coffee thermos, and all of a sudden we see within a two or three frames almost nothing that correlates to any previous frame, and all of a sudden we are again out of bits, or almost out of bits. So what do you do, right? Tough challenge for the encoder, and the answer is smooth it out, borrow references that are close, and hope for the best. And again, you're gonna see this for 40-ish, 41 milliseconds. Are you really gonna care? Probably not, my opinion. So, okay, what are we doing today? The station's deployed. It looks just like any other TV station you probably set up. It's got things that send out streams. There's overhead, or rather administrations and monitoring. And there is a signal chain that goes to a mux, to a modulator, to an amplifier, to a mask filter, and an antenna. This is just like every other station. So I'm not doing anything weird. There's no changes in the actual underlying transport or physical layer whatsoever. This is a classic, just 8VSB. Transport stream in and air out. So what did D2D really make happen here? Steve and his merry band of software folks gave me a mux, and we tried putting some VBR through it, and boop. Rate estimation doesn't like that. Continuity gaps in the PCR, because the output rate matches the input rate, but the input rate's long averaging,